Hello and greetings from the Harshaw House in the Catskill Mountains of New York. I'm Eric Francis Coppolino, your astrologer for the next 45 minutes or so. Here with the first of the sign and rising sign readings in the series known as Easy Does It. That's a kind of a strange concept in the 21st century. There's got to be a joke in there somewhere. After long preparation, I'm now ready to begin doing these readings. The warm-up reading, which generally explains the astrology, was published yesterday. And now I'm here to work through Aries and Aries rising. I have spent the morning doing a project about the goddess Vesta and the Sibyllic Vestals, which seems to be a fictional concept that has come up. And in any case, I have had, honoring this, a fire going outside in a little fireplace out there. And said fire is currently still burning, well contained and safe. And with the fire sprite guarding it. And I'm here to introduce you to your astrology. But before we open up the chart, I've got the chart ready on camera two. We'll get a look at it. And you may have seen this one. I've used this for a couple of other demonstrations. I want to talk about what I think is the kind of the cosmic elephant in the room. Which is the incredible pain and alienation that the world is in right now. I think it is astounding that this is not any kind of a topic of conversation, as if the actual state of the human race is completely invisible to nearly everyone and everything and all forms of perception. And we can't really talk about this issue of the alienation, the pain, the economic struggle, which that seems to be the thing that breaks the surface more than the personal struggle that so many people are in. And this is not just strictly about this moment. It seems to have worked its way up through the years of digital overexposure, and now we're in this moment of maximum newfound highly energized subversive digital overexposure, where people are resorting to generative pre-trained transformer models for actual companionship. I don't mean like knowing that it's fictional. I mean actual companionship and or seeking some form of divine contact through these things, and many people are seeking therapy through them. And I think that it's a very weird state, and I think also indicative of the level of sheer desperation that so many people are in. And I want to just speak to that. And part of why I'm beginning with this is because, first of all, there is a lot of Chiron in your chart right now. I mean, we're going to see this in a second, that the conjunction of Chiron and Eris would count for a lot of Chiron. And a lot of Chiron can mean a lot of a crisis and a lot of transformation, a kind of a critical turning point that we are at and that you may be at. And yet there's no room in the cultural lexicon to consider anything like a critical turning point of any kind. But fortunately, we're not in the dominant paradigm of society. We're off the reservation. We have left the normal, very restricted, narrow tunnel vision map of consciousness, and we're going to put the story of your life and the story of the world onto this beautiful thing known as a wheel. We're going to look at the wheel from above, and we are free to populate and seek the counsel of any manifestation of humanity or of the divine. That's the beautiful thing about astrology, is that really anything is welcome. And also, I think it's up to the astrologer to make sure that the right people are invited to the party, And that can include people not necessarily welcome there, but also understanding the role that they have. So this reading is oriented on the sign and the rising sign Aries. It could potentially be very helpful to those with your moon in Aries, and that's because the moon's presence in a sign provides kind of a total sensitivity to that sign. And so let's call this for sun, moon, and rising. And plus, there's a lot of people with Chiron in Aries who were born basically, let's see, Chiron, that's approximately 1968 to 1977, with a little bit of a margin on either side of that. So again, 9 years from 68 to 77, and you will be in some stage, early, middle, or late, or pre-return of your Chiron return. And there's other people scattered throughout the wheel who will be affected profoundly by this, and that includes, for example, people born in the late 1980s with your Chiron in Cancer, and a number of others. So this reading will have utility, and I think it's particular Aries. We need to speak to the entire human condition, but we're really, you can take this more personally. So when I say a lot of Chiron, there are times, and all astrologers who work with Chiron know that there are times when Chiron is more active and times when it's less active. And the times when it's more active include when it is making a conjunction to another planet or any major aspect to another planet, and when there's a mutual aspect in the sky, in the case of Chiron conjunct Eris, which it's been warming up for a couple of years, and it had its first peak earlier this year in the spring. It'll have a second peak in October or November, I think, and then a third peak in the spring of 2026. And there is this influence that is not being addressed by the world, and largely it's because people are ignorant of it, but they're not ignorant of the effects. They just don't know to consider the possibility that the effects they're witnessing may be from something that they cannot see, something that is underlying the nature of everything. And that something is represented by Eris in your sign. Now, pretty much every living person, unless you are 100, basically, has Chiron in Aries. Chiron was making its transition from Pisces into Aries in the early 1920s. It was pretty much done by around 1925. It took a long time to translate from Pisces into Aries. It kept going back and forth over the imaginary line between, of the Aries point. And so, unless you are a centenarian or you're like maybe 98, close to 100, you're going to have Chiron, Eris and Aries. And Eris and Aries is the sigil of what's happened to humanity under the influence of mass broadcast conditions. It completely, completely transformed humanity into something that had never before been seen. And I know that McLuhan talks about how the effects of the book were suddenly unraveled overnight by radio. And I think it is much more profound than that. I think that because there was never anything like this, humanity has become this completely different thing. And that thing is much more of a tribal being than an individual being. And the thing with Aries is really symbolic of individuality. And yet we have this effect of tribalizing, of de-individuating, of unraveling what an individual person is about under the influence of not really Eris and Aries, but all of the things that have been kind of hosed on humanity very, very rapidly. And we've seen a couple of generations of this go by. I mean, for example, prior to the current time, we saw the whole social media environment completely unravel and co-opt and seize the concept of friendship. And then now here we are in the age of allegedly the age of AI, which all that crap was AI going back. But the age of AI, where we are now seeing these generative pre-trained transformer models kind of completely seize and co-opt the notion of intelligence, of intellect, of originality, and people are having all kinds of experiences which to me are reminiscent of dropping acid and thinking that you're Jesus. I mean, I think this is really what is happening to a lot of people. They're like, suddenly, oh my God, I'm liberated, I can write, without of course sweating all the bullets that that all writers go through, the 48 drafts of your early articles, which may someday be replaced by like 3 to 5 drafts of your modern, articles when you're finally old and you don't have to rewrite 48 times and have the whole room sprinkled with crumpled up balls of paper. There's quite a bit of, let's say, dropping acid and thinking that people are gurus. And this is disturbing to me because it is removing the motivation to create, which is a veiled form of the motivation to grow, and replacing it with a kind of a sort of bullshit protein shake that has nothing to do with actual spiritual progress and nutrition, but is sometimes said to, where it's like, oh, this is so wonderful. So we are, and you are likely to be, unless you have a very, very strong sense of who you are, a very strong sense of belonging, and a, like so highly cognitively performative that it might come with certain debilities, have been caught in this trance of mass communication that has been going on since Eris and Ares began a century ago. And now, for the second time during that century of Eris and Ares, Chiron is making a conjunction to Eris. And Chiron is what you might think of the exact polar opposite influence of Eris. Instead of being about some kind of a tribalizing influence, Chiron is the urgent need to focus who you actually are, the need to focus your true distinct being. And Chiron almost always involves some kind of a struggle, a healing crisis, a growth crisis, a medical crisis. They can come and go at different times in life. And what this is about, and that can also include various forms of revelation and self-discovery and waking up and all this, but what this is about is the awakening to who you are and always were, as let's say provoked or instigated by the presence of Chiron conjunct Eris in your sign. And this is going to affect everyone a little bit differently. And I suspect that there are going to be people who are absolutely thrilled to suddenly be awakening, and then we are having all kinds of false awakenings. So, like the people who are completely committed to the notion that the dinosaurs didn't exist, knowing absolutely nothing about geology and paleontology, it just feels good to tell them that they have been lied to. And I would use the term for that false awakening. So there's a lot of false awakening going on under the influence of Chiron conjunct Eris. We might move the concept of false awakening to the Saturn-Neptune conjunction. We're going to get to that in a second, because there's two major conjunctions going on in your sign. For the sake of not having a conceptual mystery, the two conjunctions are Chiron and Eris right here. Eris being the slow-moving one, that's the one that's been in Eris for a century. Chiron takes 50 years to go all the way around. So that means it's making its second conjunction to Eris. The first one in Eris was in 70, I believe, 71, 72. The other conjunction going on right now in Eris is the conjunction of Saturn and Neptune. And just for full disclosure, Saturn and Neptune are going to return to Pisces very briefly, and they're going to come back into Aries, where they're going to form their one and only exact conjunction, and that will be, I believe, in February of 20 of 2026. So there's a buildup going on here. And these are both absolutely extraordinary events. You could even water this astrology down to almost nothing and say, talk about Saturn going into Aries would be enough for me to write like the entire annual edition based on Saturn entering Aries. Like, that's all I would need. Neptune entering Aries, I could write an entire 50,000 word astrological tome themed on Neptune entering Aries. Can do the same thing with the Chiron Eris conjunction. Again, there would be no limit to the amount that that I or another kind of verbose and competent astrologer could say. So they are huge. It's all, each one of these individually is enormous, and then you start putting them together in various combinations. For example, not only Saturn in Aries and Neptune in Aries, but a Saturn-Neptune conjunction in Aries, and not only in Aries, in the first degree of Aries, representing the place where the individual meets up with the collective. So I'm a little bit ahead of myself here. I wanted to mainly, in this illustration, just show you that there's this alignment of Saturn, Neptune, and this thing called Borsisi, which is very Saturnian-Neptunian in its whole theme of belief and the exploration and experimentation with what is true and the distinction between truth and lies and scientific facts and religious lies and scientific lies and things that are claimed to be religious facts. And if this theme interests you, and I know that I don't shut up pitching this book, but the book is called Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut, which is where the word and the fictional deity Borsisi comes from. Now, I happen to have talked to at some point in their careers all of the discoverers of Borsisi. That would be Dr. Jane Liu, Dr. Tred. Jane Liu is a fantastic planetary discoverer, astrophysicist, I believe, at MIT. I don't know where Chad Trujillo is working now. When I talked to him, he was at University of Hawaii, where Jane Liu used to be, and then the kind of Papa Smurf of these guys, Dr. Dave Jewett. Let's call Dr. Dave Jewett the humble planetary discoverer. The one who doesn't call a press conference, nor write a book called Why I Killed Pluto. And so, if you want to know more about that, send me an email, and I'll tell you the story. This is kind of intra-astronomer stuff, but I think it's pretty interesting. So anyway, my point was that neither David Jewett, nor Chad Trujillo, nor Jane Liu, the only discoverers of Borsisi, know how that thing got its name. Because it was the first planet ever named after a science fiction character. A fictional character. Not gods and goddesses, also arguably fictional, but not if they show up in your space. But Borsisi comes out of a modern science fiction book, worth reading the book because it describes the modern dilemma that we are now in with the latest version of technology that is seizing the human race, which is this generative GPT, kind of model of software. So two conjunctions going on, this one and this one, and they're both affecting you. And the process of each needs to be sorted out. Now, I don't know how this lands with someone who has not spent the last 30 years trying to figure out what Saturn is, and then also at the same time trying to figure out what Neptune is, and also during that same 30 years trying to figure out what Chiron is, and maybe half of the last 30 years trying to figure out what Eris is. When I just say this, what does it mean? But let me just say it, and to say that there are at least two distinct processes going on in Aries. And one of those is the Saturn-Neptune conjunction. And another one is this one that I am describing as Eris, this electrical mass medium dream of like all human beings are one and we're all morphing into the same thing and we're all, there is no individuality and all of this kind of basically new agey hocus pocus, which is a lot of like the theosophical writings and pretty much all of Alice Bailey are written under the thrall of electricity. Now, so what I am saying here is that all New Age religion is a product, indirectly, but nonetheless, a product of the electrical environment, because that's basically what's going on during the entire New Age movement. There is no New Age movement prior to electricity. Now, that's, I realize that's a correlation, but once you start to understand the nature of electricity, you can see it makes a lot of sense. And I've said this a lot of times about feminism. There would be no feminism if there were not electricity. That feminism is a product of, it is an idea, a set of ideologies that are a product of the disembodied, desexed, shocked out of body, shocked out of maleness and out of femaleness, with the ensuing rage that would engender, no pun intended, of electricity. And so Vesta is a sigil not just of the electrical age, but specifically of the mass broadcast communication age. That dream that we've all been induced in, which had its radio phase, its television phase, its high definition television phase, and now we're in the late digital phase, which is machines that we think can think and think. And I realize they're very compelling, but if it was for me, they would not be passing the Turing test. I'm fully aware of the fact that I'm talking to an application, and some of them are pretty cool, but it's still a software application. And what Chiron is doing, and it may be very painful and not abstract and not the subject of somebody's PhD in media studies, I'm saying that what Chiron represents is the pain of awakening to an individuality that was anesthetized by layer upon layer of this dream-inducing stuff called electricity. And that awakening may be extraordinarily painful, and it may also be extraordinarily challenging, and it may also be, in a way, personally visionary. It may be debilitating. It may be profoundly erotic in nature, because one of the things that this environment that we're in, one of the things that it does is that it prevents actual contact with our erotic nature, which is the most underlying fundamental binary. And now it's not cool to say you're part of a binary. You have to be non-binary to be cool nowadays, and you're transphobic. But I'm saying that underneath the binary that's creating the illusion of me being on the screen, hi, hardware on the screen, so I'm just zeros and ones and electrons and pixels and bits and bytes. Isn't that crazy? I seem so real. Well, I'm real to me. Look. Oh my God. What am I doing? Look, I'm wearing this cool ring. Bangs on the table. But when it's delivered to you, I am bits and bytes and pixels and electrons moving at the speed of light. What this has done has supplanted another binary, which is the basic general polarity of male and female. And I'm not saying that there's not a gender spectrum, as someone personally whose gender spectrum looks like that painting. I agree, there are many, many, many forms of gender spectrum, and there is also male and female. These are very important, and they are how the bunny rabbits out of my backyard and the deer and the snakes and the flowers all procreate. And the thing about the deer and the snakes and the flowers and the bunny rabbits and the hummingbird that visited me the other day and the porcupines climbing the tree that visited me the other night, and for that matter the praying mantis, is that they all engage in sexual reproduction, and out of that nucleus of sexual reproduction are all kinds of very important psychic effects. And what has happened is that under this century of the overwhelming enthrallment of this de-sexing, disembodying influence, we have had our sexuality slowly stripped away. And what Chiron may be doing for you is engaging you in a phase of radical awakening to your true sexual nature. And I promise you that whatever that true sexual nature is, it's not going to be represented by anything on the LGBTQ flag. That is not a valid paradigm, nor is the Kinsey scale, nor is the lesbian continuum of Adrienne Rich, that humans are magnificently complex in their emotional composition and their sexuality, but there are also two largely dominant states, and one of those states is awareness, and the other one is suppression or denial. And Eris has a lot to do with that suppression and denial, which can often be conveyed through chaos. That's how Eris works, is through gender chaos, hormone chaos, media overwhelm. And Chiron is a healing influence that is like a de-chaotifying influence that brings focus into perception, into consciousness, into self-awareness. And that experience of suddenly being able to feel the truth of who you are, the ability to see the light of who you are, the sudden recognition that could come on very strongly, that it is vitally, urgently important that you allow yourself to go through an undoing process and a sorting out process and overall a healing process, is now likely to be showing up in your consciousness as some kind of an inevitability. It simply must happen now. And you may need support. You may need guidance in this. And you are more than anything going to need the guidance of your inner teacher. And one of the beautiful things about Chiron is that it represents the inner teacher. There's a lot of different words for this. There's a Hebrew word called Shekinah. The Catholics call it the Holy Spirit or the Holy Ghost. And what we're really talking about is your inner teacher. There's a word for this in almost every spiritual tradition, but it's not a concept. It's not merely an abstract thought. It is an actual thing that you can tap into and learn from and gain benefit from in a very real and direct way. And so you are in this very unusual phase of your life that is really a cycle turning over. If you're old enough to remember what was going on for you in the early 1970s, I think it would be a very important time to go back into that era, journal some of that out. If you have any documents from that era, that those documents could include school yearbooks or autograph books of some kind. Maybe you're the type of person who saved your letters. Maybe your mom is still around and she can tell you, if you had children in that era who were old enough to remember anything, they might be able to share with you something about, your experience and to prompt your memories, sisters, siblings, brothers, things like this. If you're old enough, again, you might not be old enough. You might, I'm born in 1964. I have some recollection of what was going on in the early 1970s. I mean, my parents were absolutely viciously miserable and fighting, and my mother was on the vanguard of a whole generation of women in her family. The entire generation of women got divorced, and my mom was the first one. She does have strong leadership skills, if you're wondering where I get it from. And she was blamed for all the girls getting divorced. Her sister Joan, her cousin Janet, her cousin Maria. The only person who didn't get divorced was my cousin Mario, Janet's younger brother, who, as far as I know, has been in a solid marriage for all of these years. So that's very interesting that it didn't affect him. He was more of a traditionalist and good guy, guitar player. And I remember, and I believe it was in the Christmas of 1970, that his mom gave him a copy of George Harrison's All Things Must Pass, whatever year that came out when that was new. So that's a little bit about what I remember going on in my family in the early 1970s. a lot of people were starting to get divorced. And this was associated with women waking up to not wanting to be in these traditional marriages, to which, to some extent, they agreed, to which, to some extent, many were coerced into, and or they were not given any other choices. And these were people born in the 1940s. So there's fewer and fewer of them around. What we're going through right now is I think that the healing crisis that we're going through right now is largely suppressed by the overwhelming nature of the digital environment. I mean, I don't know how anybody can keep up with anything without multiple news teams. I mean, I have to have multiple news teams to track things. Different types of researchers on different stories. And I will say that without that, I would be completely overwhelmed. And I don't know how anybody else keeps up with anything else. And so that is part of what is pushing us back down into tribal consciousness, is all of this shit that every day we're told is so damned important. There's no time to sort it out. No time to think. And so that's this struggle between Chiron waking up and Eris kind of being dragged deep down beneath the surface of the water. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the Saturn-Neptune conjunction. Now, I have I've been articulating Chiron-Eris for longer, and it's not fair to say that Saturn-Neptune took me by surprise, but I haven't had the number of years to tell the story of Saturn and Aries over and over and over again, Neptune and Aries, which none of us has ever lived through, because the last time it was in Aries was in the late 19th century, 165 years ago. But I can tell you that this too represents a process of the individual meeting the collective, and it is likely to have you under considerable pressure. That there were things that were concealed that are coming into your awareness. There are experiences that you have had said similarly that you did not know about. There are things that you thought were a certain way, which are now turning out to not be that way at all. And there can be a real clash between ideals and reality under the influence of a Saturn-Neptune pairing like this. And they're not, they do not form a conjunction very often. Let's just remind ourselves the last one, I'm pretty sure it was in Capricorn. I'm working on a little laptop that I use for astrology. Saturn conjunct Neptune previous. Okay, that was 1989. And it was a part of a very powerful alignment in Capricorn, which included through 1989 Uranus, Neptune, and Saturn. Uranus, Neptune, and Saturn is a very, very big time. Happens to be the time when I left industry and became an independent journalist. I was just under the influence of that aspect, and I got Cancer eyes, and it was right on my seventh house. So there's a lot of pressure to wake up in the late 1980s, especially 1989, 1990. And that Chiron was in that configuration also in 1989. Chiron and Jupiter were opposite this grand conjunction going on in Capricorn. Really, really quite amazing astrology. And so we are now in a similar moment. The thing is, there have only been three previous conjunctions of Saturn, Neptune, and Aries since 1 BC. And the Leo King is said to have, I know one of his students, said to have used the super-duper astrology computer and could not find a Saturn-Neptune conjunction on the Aries point until we go back basically before the Old Kingdom in Egypt, 4500 BC, he was able to find a Saturn-Neptune conjunction. Saturn and Neptune have very stable orbits. It is likely that that is accurate, but I could not reach him, nor could I recreate that calculation. Suffice it to say, this is extraordinary, and it is the first, for all practical purposes, the first time it is ever happening, and we don't know what to do with it. And I can't exactly describe the kind of pressure that you might be under, but what I am comfortable describing the Saturn-Neptune conjunction in Aries as being is a set of resources, a set of available resources that you can tap into and have access to and draw upon, and the resources that will assist you in the synthesis of the new person that you are becoming, the new person that you are becoming. And this being might be somebody quite wholly unknown to you, the awakening process, or at least unknown to your ego, the awakening process of Chiron Eris still going on, still happening, and the formation process of Saturn and Neptune only at the beginning stages right now. This begins a whole new cycle of experience. And Saturn's going to be in Aries for quite a while, and Neptune's going to be in Aries for quite a while. So even if we just count the time frame where Saturn is in Aries, quite a long time, another 2.5 years, since we're only at the beginning of this. Now, there's two minor planets involved, and technically Eris and Chiron are minor planets. Or they're not very minor. They're more like an important minor key, not like minor like in minor leagues. Where you can see in minor league baseball they hit like in park triples and home runs all the time. Well, all triples are in park, but in park home runs. It's the minor leagues. You don't see that in the major leagues. The fielders are just too friggin' good to let the ball be bouncing around the outfield. Rather, what I see the minor planets as being are like the back streets of Paris. I lived in Paris for quite a while, and really my number one favorite thing about Paris was to come off the main streets, the ones running along the Seine, and the one with the Eiffel Tower, and the Champs-Élysées, and the Arc de Triomphe, and all this postcard bullshit that you see in Paris, and to duck through the alleyways that you might just keep walking past if you were not paying attention, or you were not a precocious young photographer roaming around the streets of Paris at 3 o'clock in the morning, feeling absolutely perfectly safe, I would add. The minor planets are like the back streets, and that's the place to be. That's the place to go, is the back streets, because there's so much there that is so interesting. And so we might say that Saturn and Neptune are representing something that is more of a formation of a certain kind, a more of a rerouting of mainstream belief and framework, and also becoming... it's like formative in the ego structure, something that you can document, even though Neptune is very squirrely and does not facilitate being documented very easily. It's quite actually difficult to document Neptune. It can disappear from the chart, and things again, weird things happen to Neptune. But there is a backstreet planet right there, and that backstreet planet right there is Borsisi. And Borsisi is about the kind of conflict between realism and belief. It is very similar to Saturn and Neptune. Now, Nessus is, Pholus, which is up here in Capricorn, that has quite a bit of Saturn-Neptune to it also. But Pholus has a whole different flavor. Pholus is like shaking up a bottle of soda on a hot day and popping it open. Whereas Borsisi is about a more exploratory, contemplative project of sorting out what is true and what is not, and also about being honest about accepting lies as true, belief, like saying, oh, well, did Jesus actually walk on water? Well, maybe he did, maybe he didn't, but let's just take that as a metaphor for what our religion is about. So, he performed miracles. He walked on water. Very nice. Did he literally walk on water? No. Might it help some people to think, put your hand in the hand of the man who walked on water? Beautiful song, right? Take a look at yourself, and you will look at others differently by putting your hand in the hand of the man from Galilee, right? The walking on water is right in there. It's a beautiful metaphor, right? He walked on water. Okay, but did he walk on water? So that's a perfect example of Borsisi. The lie that has validity, the lie or the thing undocumented, nobody was there with their iPhone recording him walking on water. And I imagine there are some people who've actually, you know, had the vision of that. But again, we're talking about, we're in Borsisi country. When we don't know, but something is accepted as true. Conversely, there are all kinds of lies that science tells, like, oh, just get as many vaccines as possible and you'll be perfectly healthy, when in fact, the more vaccines you get, the more vaccines you give your pets, the more likely you all are to get chronic illness and to, be in quite a bit of pain and shorten your lives. So the lie of medical science is that the more vaccines, the better. And as far as I understand it, there has never once, ever, ever been a vaccine that prevented a disease in a human being or an animal. It is complete horseshit. And so you might say, how do you know that? Like, what, you know, who the heck are you? You're just some guy reading astrological charts. And this guy, this guy's got 6 PhDs and 4 MDs. And he's telling me that I should take all the Pfizer shots and get a booster every 5 minutes. I'm going to believe him. This kind of controversy is the controversy of Borsisi. And with Borsisi, it is very important to establish and understand not what you want to be true. You have to go beyond what you want to be true and whether you feel bad that you were duped into believing that viruses exist because they freaking clobbered you with 100 different vaccinations, you know, before the age of 14. And that, of course, meant that they were real, but rather realizing, well, okay, there's a problem here. And it's better to accept that there's a problem. So Borsisi has that element of truth. And we are in this time of revelation right now. What I'm calling a time of awakening and also of false awakening. And so people like Mark and Sam Bailey are leading an awakening. They are vigilant chroniclers of truth. And I have verified much of their work, personally interviewed them many times. And they, especially Mark. And then at the same time, we are in this time of false awakening. Oh, the world is flat. Don't I feel better? Because now I admit that I've been lied to. Oh, the dinosaurs never lived. Don't I feel better? Now I admit that I have been lied to. Ah, those people, the patriarchy, the Rockefellers, the whoever they might be, I'm smarter than they are. I'm the one in the know. There were no dinosaurs. Well, I have you back there. Did you try to interview one? Have you found a fossil in your backyard? Have you found a fossil anywhere? Well, probably not, because you didn't go looking. So again, the time of awakening and false awakening. And I would say that this Borsisi, Saturn, Neptune represents this crisis of awakening versus false awakening, and also providing the resources that you need to form your character. And sometimes those resources are resources of faith and creativity, and maybe it's necessary to have a little creative deception. Oh, my mother wasn't so bad. But then maybe you want to be realistic and say, well, actually, you know, what did my mother really do to me? Who was this person? Like, I have some good and some bad. But let's look at the whole gamut. So we might say that Saturn, Neptune, Borsisi is being willing to look at the whole gamut of what it is that formed your character, so that you now, in this phase of character formation, have more resources available when it comes to filling out your character, learning about who you are. Okay, let's look at one more thing. And I did intend to spend most of this session on Aries, and there's a lot going on in this chart. And I've covered it in many different places. I mean, I'm sorry to have to put you through any form of a scholarship exercise to make the most of my work, but it's not all in one grand tome, and I'm working in many different media. But what we have going on also in Aries is the presence of this thing called Salacia. And what I've been saying about Salacia is that Salacia is what is innately about you as a sexual being. Who are you innately as a sexual being, apart from all the pressuring of who you're supposed to marry and when and what class you're supposed to marry into and all that stuff and how much money does the guy have or what kind of woman are you supposed to have or are you supposed to be a certain kind of person because you are LGBT or Q or I or A or M in some cases, S, you know, where's the S for self-sexual and all that? All of these things are essentially political, social, and religious constructs. And deep beneath all the social, political, and religious constructs is who you are, innately. You carry a set of innate instructions. And they're beautiful. And the closer you get to them, and the sooner you admit that you are willing to even know, encounter, be curious about, or understand your innate instructions, the sooner you will start to relax. And what I've been saying is, now in all my articles on the Family Hunger Games, which will be included on the delivery page of this reading, there's two articles, Family Hunger Games Part 1, Part 2, deals with sexual conditioning, where I bring Salacia into the story, is how we are socially conditioned by the tribe and by our family, by our parents, to modify, prune, restrict, suppress the truth of who we are as our innate self. And our innate self has a lot to do with who we are innately sexually. Of course, it's some kind of a taboo to talk about this, right? Because one of the things that all of this Family Hunger Games stuff does is it gives us all a pass from having having a real conversation until you no longer want that pass. And you have to have a real conversation and figure out, you know, what exactly it is that you need and who exactly it is that you are. So this brings the Hunger Games into these scenario. And you might think of all of these different things going on. For example, Pluto and Aquarius as being an expression of what's going on in Aries. And this is going to be true for all the signs, but it's especially true for you. And so, therefore, anything by me that you hear or read about Pluto and Aquarius, you can say, well, how is that a manifestation of what we've got going on here, right here in Aries? And so Pluto and Aquarius is a big confrontation between the individual and some form of the collective. Aquarius usually represents the elite collective, the group of specially selected people who are your friends, the various different sundry forms of groups and the pressures that they exert. Now, this is a big deal in our times. A lot of people were put in very bad position, including very serious medical conditions, based on having followed the peer pressure to take a certain injection invented by the government. And you might ask yourself how you responded in that era, in that era where all that was supposed to happen was you were supposed to do what you were told it was going to be enforced by the group and Rachel Maddow, who I played one of her audios on the last Planet Waves FM in the second block, starting at about 50 minutes, where she is putting, she, Little Miss Athenian, Aquarian, she's an Aries, but, you know, she's very heady. She's very heady. She's very left-brainy, pleading with people to go get this injection. This is in late 2021 when the problems were commonly known. We may live through another period of very intense pressure to do something. And what's going on with Aquarius, particularly where you've got it placed in the 11th place, is the question of whether you are willing to submit to that kind of conditioning, whether you are willing to stand up to it, either to confront the group or to just simply be yourself. It can be closely related. Or whether you're going to attempt to try to change something. So there's three main modes of Pluto and Aquarius, which is the individual being trampled by the group, the individual standing up to the group, making their own choices, and or engaging in a confrontation. And the third mode is in some way the individual transforming the group which seems to happen only very rarely in extremely limited situations. I expect mostly in artistic situations where the people, for example, in a theater troupe, trust one another and are willing to go with the leadership, the creative leadership of one person, or in a rock band where someone who may not theoretically be a major member of the band, the lyricist, frontman, vocalist, is willing to the group is willing to accept leadership of someone who ends up taking the role of an inner guide and an inner teacher. Okay, so that's, you know, Pluto will have that same expression, just with a slightly different flavor. Uranus in Gemini represents a complete revolution in your way of thinking, and it also includes a confrontation with this computational environment. I say this because the last time Uranus was in Gemini was the founding of modern computer science. This is taking place at the peak of World War II, starting in 1941, with Turing, Alan Turing, the inventor of the thing you're looking at in some form, the Turing machine, now known as a computer, or a phone, or a tablet, or a laptop, it's all the same thing. It goes from like 0 to 100 miles an hour in just 7 or 8 years. Now we are in that same acceleration zone. And so we all have to do something with our minds. We all have to do something with our minds in this environment. We have to adapt in some way. If for no other reason, not because you're so interested in being a computer programmer, but because you don't want to be crushed by the environment. You don't want to be basically, you know, pulverized and left behind by the environment. You just don't, you know, we all have to stay in step in some way. And even if you spend your life making wooden spoons, or you like to do your laundry by hand, there's still a measure of synchronizing to this very dominant, very powerful environment, and that's Uranus in Gemini. Sedna, by the way, 11,400 year orbit, enters Gemini right around the same time as Uranus. Very simple two ingress thing. Went in, retrograde, went back. It had been in Taurus for about 50 years, so it's moving quite quickly right now. It's at the very close end of its orbit. Given that it's going to take about 50-ish years to go through Gemini. I've checked this. I don't have the ephemeris handy. And the total orbit is 11,400 years around our sun. There's things that are a little bit longer. They're called sednoids. I don't really feel a need to use them in astrology. I've got my representative from the Sedna group in the form of Sedna herself, which to me is about a sensitivity to the environment. And sensitivity to, we might say that Sedna is the planet of what's called formal cause. The cause and form and what the environment itself induces in human beings, human subjects. And you are blessed with this, to have this in a relatively cognitive, self-aware mode. And the cognitive self-aware mode is that it's in the third house, Gemini. It's a great place to have it. Okay, so let's jump up here. We've got Mars making its way across Libra right now. That ends September 22nd. This is going to leave a mark on you. I'm glad I'm doing this reading first. There's going to be a lot of experiences during this phase, which began about a week ago, of Mars moving through Libra, which are going to form impressions on you. And they're going to be powerful impressions formed upon you. And right now, as I speak today, Mars is making a 90-degree angle to the Hunger Games pattern. Switching to a different chart, it looks like this. The ascendant's different. You can ignore that. Here's Mars in Libra. And Mars in Libra is making a series of 90-degree angles to all of these planets in the Hunger Games aspect. That would be Pholus and Ixion and Cupido and Quaoar. All the stuff that's family and tribal in nature. And so right now you're getting the pot stirred on things that are family and tribal in nature. And that's going to morph into another set of developments where, you know, right after that comes like, okay, you've got waded through that territory. Then comes the sexual development piece. And then comes the more intense relationship development piece. We develop sexuality before we develop sexual relationships. People don't like to, you know, admit this, but it is a true fact that our sexuality develops even before the idea of sexual relationships. And that's what's going to happen with Mars, is that you will are likely to have experiences and feel levels of sexual awakening that you then take into your relational situations. And this makes sense, right? You could go into a relational situation and then suddenly be like, oh, look at that. Here's some new sexual reality. But I think that it's vitally important that sexual reality be something that ferments within you first. That the prime sexuality is self-sexuality, and that everything else basically is a projection. And these can be incredibly beautiful, helpful, useful projections, and projections that are part of the karmic dance of the human race and our relationships. But ultimately, the relationship mediating everything in all of your relationships is your inner relationship to yourself, to your libido, to your inner teacher, to your what we might call your innate being, primal being, in sense of your own personal truth, which is waking up rapidly as we close this presentation, where we began with Chiron waking us all up, and in particular waking you up from this long dream of electrical mass communication and electrical tribes and the unraveling of individuality. Chiron, how by whatever means or manner, is seeking to emerge and to focus and to guide you into being awake. And so that awakening process will have cascading effects. It's important to recognize that awakening processes have cascading effects. They imply responsibility, they imply challenge, they imply commitment. And I think that you have the strength of character to bring that commitment, and you understand that it is now necessary for you to do so, to be true unto yourself, not as some kind of an option, not as some kind of a thing you put off for the future. You're being called now, today, to be self-aware, to be real about who and what you are discovering that you are. Okay, signing off from the first reading in the Easy Does It. Hey, hey, sister. Hey, bro. Easy does it. What's to worry about? Let's turn off the chart. Nope, that's turning off me. All right, chart turns off. Okay, so the other signs are resources. You now know a little bit about the houses, and you'll see them all as some expression of you in some way, assuming you have more than one sign access to. Most people do. And be on the lookout. Mark your questions. Remember your questions. Write them down, preferably with a pencil and paper. And then wait for an invitation to one of the next meetings. There will be several more. All right. Signing off from the Harshaw House at 12:21 p.m. on the 19th of August, 2025. Please tell your dog your cat, your goat, your horse, thy son, my love. Bye for now.